you know, and I mean, and I didn't even throw in NATO expansion and the history of warnings that came from the United States about the consequences of NATO expansion. I didn't throw in 2014, the coup, Victoria Nuland's role, and what was the true objectives of that. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that is there that is no longer there when people say unprovoked war of aggression. It just comes down to basically they start, I think, on February 21st or around there when Vladimir Putin gave his initial speech, which people said, that's historical revisionism. This is a madman. This is a guy who's trying to reinvent history. He's trying to commit genocide against the Ukrainians. And boom, on 24th of February, the troops go across the border. And there it is, an unprovoked war of aggression carried out by a madman who is guilty of historical revisionism. And that's the theme, and they've been consistent throughout. But as we gather data and we start to plug things in, we find out that, lo and behold, what people were calling historical revisionism on the part of Putin actually is a heck of a lot more factually based than the counter arguments being put out by others. Stepan Bandera was an evil man. Banderism is a ideology that is manifest today and a significant factor in Ukrainian government. They have made him a national hero. They do have statues to him. They do sing songs in praise of him. They have transformed the entire youth movement of Ukraine to be in the image of Bandera and his hateful ideology. Yeah, suddenly sure. You're sitting there going, wow, Putin might have a point, but we're not allowed to say that because this was an unprovoked war of aggression. Right. But the thing that has escaped most analysts' point of view, because a lot of the Bandera stuff, I mean, I have very good friends who I plan on staying good friends with. But if we got down this path and we went down, we wouldn't be friends. Because when I hear them say, look, Bandera, you know, the atrocities he committed were against the Soviets. He's a Ukrainian nationalist who was compelled to do bad things to defend Ukraine from the evils of Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union. Therefore, mass murder is okay. And I'm like, no, it's not okay. It wasn't good. Stalin did it, and it's not good when Hitler did it, and it's not good when Bandera does it. Mass murder is never a good thing. But even if you take that off the equation, we have to go to the intent of Russia.
Yeah.
If you're going to carry out an unprovoked act of aggression and you initiate your military operation in a manner which is designed to compel your opponent to get to the peace table as soon as possible and complete a peace agreement as soon as possible, you have to ask yourself, why? Why is that your motive? If this was an unprovoked war of aggression, why are you seeking to swamp the army, to capture the capital, to execute the leadership? Why are you preserving the leadership, preserving critical infrastructure, preserving everything that otherwise would be taken off the map? And you have to question now, what is the intent? And the intent of Russia appears to have been, we know it is now the case, to get the Ukrainians to the negotiating table, to come to a rapid conclusion of this conflict, because that's consistent with Russia's history over an 8-year period for a peaceful resolution to this problem. So, off the bat, go ahead.
This is good, because this is now getting into kind of what I wanted to do with you in this recording, which is go through kind of chronologically what happened this year. So in the background, we have that revolution in 2014, which was strongly supported by the US, in which they call themselves Ukrainian nationalists, Banderites. I think there's a case to call them Nazis. And they played a prominent role. And there's admissions, right, from people like one of these guys, Yevhen Karas, explained, you know, we have fun killing, we have fun fighting, you know, nationalists were the key factor in the 2014 Maidan revolution. Yeah. And they said, you know, he kind of dismissed the idea that they were numerically not important. He said, you know, if there's, yeah, okay, there was only eight, we were only 8%, but we were much more effective than the rest. If not for the nationalists, then the whole thing would have turned into a gay parade.
He also is quite clear that it's not the total numbers. It's the percentage of your numbers that are willing to commit acts of violence in support of their cause. And when you have the right sector working for Svoboda, who gangs up is empowered by the government to work with the Ministry of Interior to form street gangs whose job is to intimidate, beat up, and otherwise terrorize a population. It doesn't matter that when you go to the poll, only 8% of the population votes for you. When you turn your numbers into 100% of the intimidation, yeah, you are in control of Ukraine. And anybody who doesn't believe that the right sector is not in control of Ukraine, and I'm talking about every aspect of Ukraine, there's not a single Ukrainian out there who isn't intimidated by the right sector.
That's maybe arguably Zelensky himself.
He has been threatened with his life.
Yeah,
there are videos. If you sign Minsk, you will be hung by the neck until dead on the streets of Kiev.
Yeah.
Now, in the United States, if I threaten an American president like that, I get visited by the Secret Service.
You would never be seen again. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then the war starts in Donbass in eastern Ukraine, where there's a huge number.
Well, the war doesn't start.
Right shortly after 2014.
That implied what happened was the right sector began terrorizing ethnic Russian people. That's not a war.
Yeah.
It's terrorism.
And a lot of Russians rise up
to preserve their communities, preserve their lives, preserve their way of living. And then the Ukrainian government, which is not the Ukrainian government, is the right sector dominated coup government, calls all the Russians who are defending their lives, their livelihood, and their way of life terrorists, and they enact anti-terrorism legislation, which unleashes the Ukrainian army on the Russians.
Yeah.
Again, we're not talking war yet. We're talking about a government terrorizing
a specific segment
of the population.
And these are Ukrainians. We're calling them Russians, but they're Russian-speaking
ethnic
Ukrainians.
Russians, but they're Ukrainian citizens. Yeah.
I think you could argue it was after some time that they kind of went the separatist route. They originally, I think, wanted to stay.
They viewed themselves as the only legitimate patriots. Viewed themselves as Ukrainian citizens who supported the constitutionally elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych.
Yeah.
They were not in support of this illegal revolution, this illegal coup d'etat supported by outside powers and empowered by a minority Banderist ideology.
Yeah.
So any concept that this was Russia coming in, generating trouble to try and get the Russian ethnic Russians to separate is just absolute horse hockey. Yeah,
it doesn't fit. It doesn't seem to fit the chronology. Yeah. So then that's like what's going on locally in 2014. But then in the big picture, I think there's something else that happened that leads to what's happening today, which is, I think, and you tell me if you agree, but it seems to me that at some point in the past, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, Russia's military industrial complex either caught up to or surpassed what the US could do. So there's a feeling that Russia doesn't have to just have these things imposed on it anymore by the US.
Right. Look, the Russia of the 1990s was a basket case.
Yeah.
The post-Soviet Russian space was, especially from the military standpoint, was just an absolute travesty from a Russian perspective.
Yeah. Mortality goes way up beyond.
Your life expectancy of your average man drops significantly. Alcoholism is rampant. Family units are falling apart. The whole country is disintegrating. The economy is an absolute shambles, being exploited by Western capitalist interests who come in and use the oligarch class to extract wealth and then remove it from Russia, not reinvesting it into Russia. And it is just a downward trend. It's literally out of control, and the West is doing nothing to stop it. Throw that on top of that, you have conflicts such as the one that took place in Chechnya. You have other conflicts on the borders. The Georgian conflict in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. You have conflicts in Nagorno-Karabakh. So you basically, you're looking at a landmass that is disintegrating politically and is dissolving economically. And you superimpose on that a military structure. And remember, it's not just the infantry, the army. We're talking about nuclear nuclear forces. We're talking about submarines with ballistic missiles. We're talking about road mobile missiles. We're talking about missiles and silos. We're talking about nuclear weapons that go on bombers. The whole enterprise is there. And the Russians went into, you know, how when a body gets shocked, how it automatically starts concentrating blood where it needs to be, you know, around the heart, around the brain, around the critical organs, and everything else just goes into shock. Well, that was what happened to Russia and the military. The military concentrated resources where it had to survive. But that wasn't in the rank and file military. And we saw this when in 1993, I believe, or 94, early 94, when the Russians went into Grozny. And the initial regiment that went in there was literally cut off and slaughtered by a couple hundred Chechen rebels. We're not talking about well-organized. We're not talking about well-trained. We're just saying that this group of Chechens destroyed a Russian regiment.
There's a military question in there, actually, because I read somewhere that kind of lesson of, you know, making hay for the capital and kind of waving the flag and then getting surrounded and destroyed was something they have not repeated. And it's also maybe helps explain how slow their advance has been in Ukraine as well, where they're very sensitive to getting surrounded and destroyed or like overreaching their lines. I mean,
I think that the Russian army of today is casualty averse.
Yeah.
Now we say that and we have to also recognize that this war, Russia has suffered, more dead in this conflict than they suffered in 10 years in Afghanistan. They're getting close to suffering the amount of dead that the United States suffered in 10 years in Vietnam. So I don't want to pretend that there's no Russians dying. They're dying in droves. This is a bloody war, the scope and scale of which nobody in the West can begin to comprehend. And that's not my words. That's the words of General Cavoli, the head of the U.S. Army in Europe and the Allied forces. He spoke in Sweden in January, and he basically said that. He said, what's going on there, we couldn't even imagine. We're not trained for it, equipped for it, ready to fight it. We're going to get there, he thinks. I don't think so. But he was just like, well, how do you even begin to comprehend a war where the minimum daily shells being fired by Russia is 20,000. And that's sort of the annual expectation of this. During the entire Desert Storm, the United States fired 60,000 rounds for the entire Desert Storm. The Russians sometimes fire 60 to 80,000 in one day.
And I gather if you're anywhere near one of these shells landing, it's like PTSD for life. Like it shakes your brain and your head. And
well, it ain't good. But we'll get into that, because now we get into probability of kill and then probability of casualty, probability of effect, and how we calculate casualties. But you asked a question, a military question. Mm-hmm. Even though the Russians recognized they had a problem in Chechnya, they didn't have the resources to rapidly resolve it. And they fought a very bloody, ineffective war. The first Chechen war. Then they had a second Chechen war, and they got a little bit better, but still it was very difficult. From 1999 to 2005, it was very difficult for the Russians. They started to transition into what they call contract soldiers, because they recognized that the conscripts just weren't up to the task. They weren't trained enough. And, you know, the whole way of two-year conscripts is just self-defeating, because the second year conscript beats the hell out of the first year conscript, who learns that. So when they become second year conscripts, they beat the hell, and it just happens. And it's just a bad way of doing business. So they transitioned to contract soldiers, more of a professional force. And the second Chechen war was won primarily because of contract soldiers. People
and then presumably some kind of relationship with Kadyrov, and they managed to win over.
The political aspect, the hearts and minds. But Kadyrov didn't come over until he realized he wasn't going to win. Once it became clear that the Russian army was there, meant business, and you weren't going to prevail, suddenly you can have your bright light going off, going, oh, if I continue to do this, I'm going to die. And then you begin to second guess why you're doing it. You also have to get into who's helping you and why are they helping you? Why is the CIA working with you against Russia? Is the CIA doing it because they like you, or are they doing it because you're accomplishing something for them? And suddenly you realize you're on the wrong side and you switch over, and suddenly the hearts and minds have been won and the war's over. And that was a good thing, 2005. In 2008, though, was to me the big wake-up call.
Right.
What happened in 2008 is that Russia fought a very short war with Georgia. But the Georgian infantry, especially, had been trained by the United States Marines, actually. And it's not me saying this. I mean, I'm a Marine. I'm very proud of the combat capabilities of my brother and sister Marines. But it's the Russians themselves who said the small unit tactics used by the Georgians were outstanding. The way they fired, the way they maneuvered, the way they provided support, the way they communicated, it was echelons above what we could do. We won because we came in with mass. We won because we could just blow them off the face of the earth with artillery. They didn't have good fire support. They didn't know how to employ their armor. But from at the small unit level, the Georgians outclassed the Russians night and day, and the Russians admit it. They were like, holy cow, if we had to go up against a NATO force where everybody's trained to that level on across the board, we would lose, and we would lose dramatically. And so that's sort of the wake-up call for the Russians that went, we have to rethink this whole thing. And from 2008 until 2014, the Russians got into the business of, first of all, re-equipping soldiers. To be an effective soldier, you have to have uniforms that are up to the task. You have to have body armor. You have to have communications devices that enable you to communicate, weapons that are effective. And so they, if you take a look at the Russian soldiers fighting in 2008, and they're pretty much kitted out like your average Soviet soldier in Chechnya and Afghanistan earlier, and you look at the little green men that were running around Crimea in 2014, totally different, completely different people. The uniforms are different. The whole method of operating is different because they were learning. They were getting better. But they weren't done there, because in 2014 and 2016, they said, you know, we if we're going to be fighting NATO, we need to bring back these formations like the First Guards Tank Army and the 20th Combined Arms Army, and bring them back. And, you know, we have to start looking at tanks. We have to start looking at artillery, not to fight small wars, but big wars. And they started reorganizing. And when you do that, your defense industry has to kick in. See, from 2008 to 2014, the defense industry was focused on what I would call the small stuff. But starting in 2016, it became the big stuff. Tanks, and artillery.
And probably thinking of Ukraine. I mean, ultimately, by then, they would have known this was going to be the direction. I mean, Syria, too. You know, they have some...
No,
some
Syria...
Small for them.
Syria was a sideshow. They did well, but Syria wasn't like Afghanistan to us. To us, Afghanistan elevated U.S. Central Command into the central decision-making body for all of the military. Everything from recruiting to equipping to training was all focused on low-intensity conflict. Syria doesn't drive the Russian military that way. It's a sideshow where units adapt to Syria, but Syria doesn't force the entire Soviet or Russian army to adapt to it.
Yeah. So it seems to me Russia is preparing a long time, thinking of Ukraine, thinking of NATO coming through Ukraine. I mean, basically, yes.
Starting in 2014, that was that became clear. The reason why they took Crimea was to keep it from falling in the hands of NATO, keep it out of Ukraine's hands.
And you've already mentioned the initial phase of the war. I think we can safely move into the February, you know, the first couple months where, you know, again, you were saying they're making these big moves, and it makes what makes the most sense is that Ukraine is going to probably have to surrender. And then something happened and Ukraine just didn't give up. And, you know, the U.S. told them, we think probably the U.S. told them the Boris Johnson went, by the time Boris Johnson went, probably they had already decided they weren't going to negotiate. But like these big moves where they threatened Kiev and everything were probably trying to get Kiev to go back to the deal that they had, right? The Minsk agreements. And
well, it would be beyond Minsk because, you know, Minsk was about keeping Donbass as part of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately for the Ukrainians, when they decided they didn't want to play the game, and, you know, for Russia to go to war in Ukraine, and people need to respect this about Russia. You can say they're manipulating, you know, legal arguments, but the bottom line is they are assiduous about international law.
Yeah.
And so, and they're assiduous about domestic law. The Russian president cannot order the Russian army into foreign territory without the permission of the Duma. And the Duma is constitutionally prohibited from ordering Russian troops to invade other countries without just cause. And the Donbass was Ukrainian. Now, an interesting thing, you know, just an aside, a lot of people are talking about Wagner right now.
Yes.
Wagner, part of the private military contractor, Wagner this, Wagner that. Well,
oh, they recruit prisoners, criminals.
Well, they recruit people who are going to accomplish the mission. And prisoners, when given a chance for redemption through fire, become very enthusiastic fighters, and they're cheap. So, you know, but they don't do that anymore. They stopped doing that because I think there was a lot of controversy about that.
Yeah, they
were. Plus, they weren't. The problem with prisoners is that many of them are. There's a reason why they were prisoners.
Yeah,
and you don't necessarily get redemption by fire that you're looking for. You learn how to fight. And you use those skills to exact revenge on other people and things. So I think they shut that thing down. But Wagner was created because the Russian military, well, you know, with, as the separatists became separatists in 2014, 2015, they started to organize to take on the military, but they're still lacking certain skill sets. They're receiving equipment from the Russians, old T-64 tanks and things of that nature, but they, you know, they have a limited amount of manpower that can operate this stuff. And so, but the Russian military is prohibited constitutionally from coming over and supporting them. So what would happen is they created the Russian, Prigozhin might take exception to this, but that's his business. My understanding is that the Russian general staff.
Are you suggesting that the Wagner Group is not a completely independent institution with no and
the Wagner Group works for the Russian general staff and only for the Russian general staff. It doesn't work for anybody else but the Russian general staff. And the Russian general staff got Prigozhin to create an alternative, an alternate funding mechanism outside of that which is mandated by the Duma for the Russian military, because again, they believe in the rule of law. You can't. And so they set up this mechanism, and Wagner was created. Wagner initially had a lot of what we call sheep dipping going on. So let's say you're the 8th Armored Brigade of the Russian army. But then suddenly all your guys sign documents that get out of the Russian army.
Right.
They sign documents that give them a short-term contract with Wagner. And then they hop into the same tanks and they go storming into Ukraine to fight the Ukrainian army.
Is this a little bit like Blackwater in Iraq?
No, Blackwater is near. Wagner is orders of echelons better than anything, better than Blackwater. Blackwater was okay, but Blackwater had very limited scope. Blackwater was never designed to be a armored brigade.
Right.
Blackwater was never designed to carry out shock assaults in an urban environment. Blackwater didn't have its own artillery. While they did have some helicopters, they never had their own air force. When's the last time you saw a Blackwater guy running around with an F-15?
It's always Wagner the same has special all of force. This
because that's what you need to fight a war. So Wagner is the Russian military, but it's a contract vehicle that constitutionally allows the military to operate on the soil of the Donbass, of Donetsk and Luhansk. And they're very effective, so effective that in 2014, they surrounded 10,000 Ukrainian troops in a village north of the city of Donetsk, and they were going to wipe them off the face of the earth. This is why we got the Minsk agreements. We got the Minsk agreements because the Ukrainian government, we're about to lose our army, they said. So how do we prevent this? And Germany and France went, we'll step in and we'll get a ceasefire. And they twisted Putin's arm, because Putin doesn't want a war. Anybody who says this is something Russia wanted doesn't understand Russia. The last thing Russia wanted was a conflict in Donbas. It was thrust upon them. Putin in 2005, again, people forget that, you know, there's a CIA analyst out there who I like a lot. He's a good friend of mine, Principal Ray McGovern. And Ray's an old Soviet analyst. He's so old that he predates the Soviet analyst division of the CIA. He was there before SOVA. But Ray, he taught me something very important. He said, if you want to know what Soviets and Russians are thinking, listen to them.
Right.
Just listen to them.
Instead of listening to what the experts say.
Don't listen to interpretations. Don't listen to this. Listen to them, because they tend to say what they mean and mean what they say. And right. Putin in 2005 gave a speech to the Russian Federal Assembly, and it's been widely misquoted. It's the speech where he said one of the greatest tragedies of the last century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's been turned into the greatest tragedy of the last century was the collapse of the Soviet Union, full stop. And everybody says Putin is a madman. He wants to come back and return to the Soviet. If you think Vladimir Putin wants to return to the Soviet Union, you don't know anything about Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
But the most important thing is what he said after that, because overnight, tens of millions of Russians became homeless.
Orphaned, yeah.
He is the Russian president, and he is responsible for the Russian nation. And the Russian nation is not defined by the borders of the Russian Federation. The Russian nation is defined by the Russian people, and the Russian people are defined by their ethnicity, their religion, their culture, and their language. And so when you have a large number of Russians, not Russian citizens, but Russians in Donbass being attacked by Ukrainian nationalists who view them as subhuman, who have a track record. Again, this escapes most people. A lot of people might be familiar with Volyn, the massacre in Volyn, 1943, 1944, where the Ukrainian nationalists under Stepan Bandera slaughtered 110,000 Poles, mainly women and children and old men. And they slaughtered them in the most horrible way possible. We don't know, need to get into it. Use your imagination. But what a lot of people don't focus on is the over 200,000 Russian citizens that were slaughtered by the Banderas from 1945 to 1953, when Ukraine was a wild, wild west where these bands were running around. They'd surround villages, slaughter everybody. The Russians have documented. They have it all there, but people tend to forget about it. They don't want to hear about that. Well, the Russians haven't forgotten. And the Russians know that the Banderas view them as subhumans, as people not worthy of life, to be slaughtered. And so when the successors, the follow-on generations of Banderists start turning to ethnic Russians in the Donbas and call them orcs, call them Muscal, which is an insulting term for Muscovite for Russians. You have to take seriously the possibility of genocide, because what they're carrying out is a cultural genocide off the start, where they delegitimize the language, the religion, the culture, the identity, and the next step to that is cancellation. And then if you're still there, they kill you. And this is what they do historically.
There was that speech by Poroshenko where he said, their kids will be hiding in cellars and our kids will be going to kindergarten.
And that's the mildest speech. There's other speeches about how they're going to go out there. And well, it's not just speeches. We saw what they did in Odessa, where they stuffed 150 people into the trade union building, set it on fire, and cheered as 48 of them died. So it's real.
Yeah, exactly. So they didn't surrender in March or April. But I think that was like an unfortunate surprise from the Russian perspective, which I think that was their goal.
So it was their goal. Their goal was not to invade and defeat. It was to invade and compel.
But then the fortunate surprise, I think, probably Russia was also surprised by this at least a little, was that the sanctions, all the sanctions didn't actually work, and that India, China, and lots of the global South just didn't go along with them. They refused to join.
But this was not some analysts like me, in December, I specifically wrote the sanctions would backfire and that it would collapse the European economy for this. But you know what? If you look at my resume, you're not going to see a PhD in economics. Right. I know a lot. I think I understand a lot. But the bottom line is, just because I'm certain of something doesn't mean it is or others share my certainty. And what we know now about the inner circle around Vladimir Putin is they did not share my certainty, that they were very concerned about the economic consequences of sanctions. A lot of people say, why didn't the Russians mobilize? Why didn't they mobilize up front? Why didn't they declare war? Well, we know phase one was designed to be quick and use a peacetime complement to overwhelm and compel to surrender. But when that failed and they moved into phase two, the basically from April until August, and it became this meat grinder operation where they concentrated their resources in the Donbass, but left wide open their flanks in Kharkov and Kherson. Why didn't the military say, hey, boss, we're undermanned on the flanks. This is a very risky thing. We don't have, our defense in depth where we have huge gaps in our line. We need to mobilize. We need to get more troops. But Putin is sitting there thinking the following. I mean, again, people disregard this as part of the ignorance of people who call Putin a dictator or an autocrat. Putin is a democratically elected president of a nation that has democracy. It might be imperfect in our eyes, but it's a Russian democracy. And he is accountable to the Russian people, who can and will vote him out of office if he fails to respect their wishes. This was not a popular war. The decision to go into Ukraine was not a popular decision at all. It was a necessary decision from the leadership standpoint, but not a popular decision. So one way that you mitigate a massive rise in unpopularity is to keep it as a peacetime complement. I mean, the soldiers that are already in the military are the ones you're going to fight. You're not going to prevail on the citizens to cough up more men. And that's okay in phase one. But now you come to phase two, and the military is saying, we might need more resources. But phase two, Putin's still sitting there going, what about the economy? What about the economy? Because it wasn't certain what China was going to do. China has this Westphalian principle position about sovereignty. And China was like, we're not too happy about this invasion thing. We don't like that. India, the same way. We're not too pleased about this. There were no guarantees that China and India would open up their economies. That was still a negotiation in process.
Exactly.
There was no guarantee that Russia would be able to successfully entangle itself from Western economic structures. And if they were unable to untangle, then sanctions really would have hurt, because now the Russian economy is tied to the Western economy. And so sanctioning it can cause the collapse that the West was looking for. So Putin's in the business of disentangling a significant percentage of the Russian economy, trying to transition the other economy there while he's fighting a war that's expensive. And he's going, holy cow, I can't. If I'm asking the Russian people to tighten their belts and face up to maybe 15, 20, 25% contraction in the economy, I can't turn around and mobilize. This would be suicide. It would do what the West wants and could lead to what the Ukrainian government wants and the Western government wants, which is a Moscow Maidan moment where the Russian people rise up in the street and throw Putin out on his ear. So he has to tread very carefully managing the economy, managing the conflict, and he can't do the things that we in the West say, well, that was logic. He should have mobilized them. No, he couldn't mobilize them.
Right. So what happens then is, surprise, maybe to some extent, that China and India don't go along with the sanctions. And then a little bit maybe of surprise that Germany is so willing to sacrifice its own economy for the sake of this war. That went a little bit beyond what I think anybody...
All of Europe, not just Germany, especially Germany, because of the absolute dependence on gas, but the whole lemming to a cliff mentality of Europe to say, we're going to sanction, the consequences be damned, if I could say that on your air. I apologize,
yeah, kind of
offended by that language. But no, that was very surprising as well. And
then we have Seymour Hersh's article, which is in June, in the middle of this process. The U.S. apparently sent deep sea divers to put bombs on the pipelines, which they then later blew up in September.
Yeah, well, we knew, I mean, it's not that this was a surprise when you have Joe Biden on February 7th in front of Olaf Scholz in White House say, yeah, if Russian tanks move into Ukraine.
Smirked. I haven't seen him smirk like that since he was calling you Scotty boy.
Yeah, Scotty boy. But did you see Olaf Scholz's face?
Yeah.
He looked like a scared kid.
Yeah. And I don't
was just like,
yeah. And Hirsch's article says there's really not that many people that, I mean, Biden knew, but they didn't tell everybody that they were going to do it.
They just did it.
And I honestly, Scott, this is one of the things I still haven't wrapped my head around. I can't believe that they would do that to Germany. Like it's Germany, you know, like it's their ally. It's
well, but the history of, I mean, yes, superficially, you're 100% correct.
Yeah.
Allies, NATO allies, longtime friends, American troops, the Brotherhood, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you go back to since the 60s, the United States and Germany have been clashing about Ostpolitik, about the German desire to have good relations with the East. We didn't want that. Germany wanted to open up its economy early on to allow Russian gas and Russian energy to come in. We didn't want that. Germany wanted a peace treaty. We didn't want that. So there has been conflict and tension and friction between the United States and Germany for decades. And the Nord Stream pipelines, Nord Stream 1, which I think came into being somewhere around 2012, and then Nord Stream 2 came in 2018, 2019.
Yeah.
But we were dead set against both of those. We did not want them. We viewed that as the Russians getting economic leverage over Europe. It was, you know, sending us in the wrong. And Germany's looking at it saying, no, that's what makes us work. You see, we get this cheap Russian gas and we can save, because you just said, you know, 200 billion euros in subsidies to keep up. Well, imagine if that's what it costs now, the difference between market price, and it won't be that high because the market's gone crazy. Well, let's say it's 100 billion a year.
Yeah.
Over the course of 20 years, that's, again, I'm marine math. I might not be the greatest in the world, but that's like 2 trillion euros that could be invested in infrastructure, healthcare, education. There's a reason why Germany has such a high standard of living. It's because they can cough up 2 trillion extra euros for reinvestment into Germany that otherwise wouldn't exist if they had to pay market price. And the United States is looking at saying unfair economic advantage, unfair competition. Germany becomes the enemy. And but that's why
Newland said, we're very gratified that it's a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea. To say that, to just like spit in the
But the point is, we've all been lulled into a false sense of normalcy, thinking that the United States is the friend of Germany. Germany's been the strategic enemy of the United States for decades. Remember the animosity Donald Rumsfeld had in the lead up to old Europe, new Europe. That is reflective of, you know, a ingrained sense of animosity between the United States and Germany that nobody's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We have viewed Germany as a strategic competitor and in some cases a strategic adversary for decades. So it should not be a surprise to anybody that we blew up their strategic energy infrastructure, because they are the enemy in this case, not just Russia, but Germany. And the Germans need to wake up. That's a domestic German problem.
It seems a very one-way
relationship. Well, now, you know, take a look at the role Germany plays in facilitating the flow of information to support, et cetera, Ramstein Air Base, Rhein-Main Air Base, the Hamburg ports. All of this is essential for flowing materiel into Ukraine. So the Germans have to wake up to the fact that not only did we stab them in the back, but we're using them as a colonial.
And their foreign minister says we are at war with Russia.
Well, Russia'd like to remind them. Hey, go to the Bundestag.
Yeah.
Exit. Turn right. There's a thing called the Tiergarten. Look at it. Yeah. You'll see there's a big memorial there. Flanking it are plinths with 2 T-34/85 tanks. That was the last time you went to war with us. Mm-hmm. We can upgrade those to T-90s anytime you want. That's what the Russians should say, but Lavrov's far too diplomat.
So now that takes us to the September to now, I guess, phase.
Well, not really. No, there's another phase that's missing in all this.
Okay.
Because, you know, the original question was casualties, and we're going to get to that in a second. Yeah. But there were significant casualties that took place in phase one. There's no doubt about that. The Russians took a big risk by pushing in so quickly without destroying things because they were trying to kill, not overwhelm. And some of their columns were cut off and slaughtered by the Ukrainians. So the Russians took heavy casualties, but they still managed to seize a lot of territory and kill a lot of Ukrainians.
I also get this sense of the, like, you know, growing up and watching the way the Americans, you know, fight, I get a different feeling. Like when I've seen Russian commentary on when their columns are surrounded and destroyed, and they're sort of like, well, it's war, what do you expect? Whereas when it happens to US soldiers, they're like, you know, no more, well, Mr. Nice Guy about it, right? So
yeah, I mean, you know, remember Nasiriya? Yeah, Nasiriya, 2003, when saving Jessica, you know, the blonde haired, good looking West Virginia girl that got taken prisoner.
Oh, I must have missed this.
You know, her 7th Motor Transport Company or whatever got lost, took a wrong turn, and they ended up going through Nasiriya, getting ambushed by the Iraqis. Most of them were killed. Some of them retreated. Some were captured. And, you know, it became a big deal that, you know, we lost troops and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the Russians, the Russian attitude would be, shouldn't have made that right hand turn.
Yeah.
It's
a little different. A little culturally different.
But the Russians took casualties, but not a lot. Yeah. But now they move into the next phase, which is this meat grinder phase. You know, we talk about the Battle of Bakhmut taking place today. That battle began in May, mm-hmm. in earnest. In May of it wasn't in Bakhmut, it was further to the east. To the west or east.
Yeah,
to the east. But that meat grinder where the Russians said, okay, no more thrusts. We're going to sit here. We're going to grind them down with artillery, massive artillery. And then we're going to move in, clear the trench, grind them down again, clear the trench.
And this is happening because this is like a very fortified
area. For 8 years, the Ukrainians have turned this into an anthill, concrete bunkers. And if you take a trench, be careful because there's a bunker there that's going to shoot down the trench line to kill you that you didn't see. And if you get traditional trench clearing operations, you would suffer horrendous casualties.
Yeah.
So, and you can't just, you know, overwhelm that one trench line because you get bogged down in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth trench line down there. It's just impossible. But so the Russians slowed it down and then just started hitting them with artillery. And they were grinding them away and they were destroying the Ukrainian army. And frankly speaking, the Ukrainians lost this war sometime in June or July of last summer.
And they lost via basically artillery destruction.
Artillery grinding them down. But then comes
the
game changer, which is not game winner, game changer. Mm-hmm. Because the game right now is Russia grinding you down to nothing. Yep. The game changer is NATO providing billions of dollars of fresh equipment that were then used to train new units using Western tactics with Western intelligence, Western communications, Western weapons. And they came in. And remember when I talked about the overextended flanks?
Mm-hmm.
When you've got, you know, 1,500 kilometers of frontage and you've put most of your troops in the central area, what's left to cover this might be 50 guys per kilometer. I don't know when the last time you went for a hike and marched off the clock, but imagine
see that guy.
just imagine defending an area of 50 guys, in some cases, 50 guys for 5 kilometers.
Right.
And there was no artillery because all the artillery was focused on the central battlefield. So all the artillery is supposed to cover that gap. So if the enemy comes in and shoots the gap between two widely dispersed defensive points, normally the artillery will hit it. Plus, doctrinally, there should be a second defense line and a third defense line to slow them down so artillery can then again hit it. There's no artillery, there's no second defense line, there's no third defense line. And these Ukrainian units that were trained to exploit the intelligence that the United States was collecting where the gap is, they just went through that gap and they kept going. And they'd go 20, 30 kilometers into the rear and start raising havoc in the Russian rear. So the Russians made the decision because they had some, I mean, and the other thing is the units that were manning the front lines were in many cases police SWAT teams.
Yeah, so there's this, there is this kind of economy of force that Russia had been applying up until mobilized.
They did it there because they couldn't mobilize, because they didn't mobilize. So they were using, they had insufficient resources to the task. All the combat effective units were gathered in the central area, and the other ones weren't. And so the Ukrainians exploited it.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's very interesting, because the Ukrainians do have, they have a real-time complete picture of where the Russians are, because the Americans are giving that to them all the time.
Yeah. And they exploited it very well. I mean, hats off to the Ukrainians. As a military person, I'm sitting there going, wow, impressive. But what the Russians did is they said, we're not going to sacrifice the lives, you know, the Hitler hedgehog. Remember in the, if you've read the history of the Battle of Moscow, when the Russians launched their winter offensive to push the Russians back, or the Germans back, Hitler ordered the troops not to retreat one inch, to hedgehog in, hold up. And they break the back of the Russian attack, absorb. Some of the hedgehogs were overwhelmed, other ones held. And eventually the Soviets lost their offensive surge, and the Germans were able to consolidate the line, but at great cost, horrific cost. Well, the Russians didn't hedgehog. They went, we're not playing that game. Everybody up to the rear. Hey, boss, we got 12 tanks that aren't fueled. Leave them. Boss, we got equipment that's not ready. Leave it. I want the manpower out of here. Abandon the equipment. We can get new equipment. We can't get new manpower. They pulled them back, and they consolidated the defensive line and started to defend doctrinally with proper unit concentration, artillery, defense in depth. And the Ukrainians ended up breaking their neck against this. And they, all those troops that they built up, they lost. Ask yourself why today the Ukrainians are begging for weaponry, because everything we gave them is gone. Ask them why they're begging for, why they're kidnapping men off the street, because we've killed all the reserves that they built up. Meanwhile, for the first time, Putin is calling his people in, and they said, hey, this is a new kind of war. This is no longer Russia versus Ukraine. This is Russia versus the collective West, Russia versus NATO.
And that happened incrementally, because it's like there's HIMARS, then there's tanks, now tanks, there's F-16s.
Right, it didn't happen all at once.
But it's sort of, and this is what makes it kind of scary, right? Because it's like there's this, they're sending this, and then the Russians have to match, and then NATO sends more. And so the
Russians never had to match. They had to adapt.
They had to adapt.
You, you know, there's three weapon systems that have proven to be very problematic for the Russians. One is the M777 American howitzer. The other one is the French César mobile artillery piece.
These are all artillery.
All artillery. And then the last one is HIMARS. Yeah. All three of these, you see the Russians, just like everybody, you fall into a pattern of behavior. So you take what the enemy is going to give you. So if the enemy is using ineffective D-30, D-20, 2S1, 2S3, Soviet era howitzers, you adapt to that, to the range and the accuracy. And so you get lazy. So for instance, you might take your command post, and instead of doing an Alpha Bravo command post, jumping it, so if you lose one, you still have command, you'll put everybody into one because it's more convenient, less gas, easier, and you'll move it up to the front, and you'll do that logistically. Instead of spreading your ammo dumps out, again, which requires a lot of vehicles and a lot of coordination, you just say, bring them all together and cluster them here. And we have a central ammunition to put. And they were doing that as part of this this meat grinder war. Mm-hmm. And suddenly these new artillery pieces come in with high precision rounds, longer range, and perfect intelligence. And so the U.S. is sitting there going, man post of the X battalion of the X brigade is right here, right now, the general's there. And the Ukrainians went, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Boom, 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 bam. You suddenly have a dead general, a dead staff. Their ammunition's all here. Boom, boom, boom. Bam, you just took out 4 days' supply of ammunition for the frontline units. And the Russians went, holy cow. So now they had to go back and adapt. First, they had to adapt the M777. They had to adapt to the César. They had to adapt to the HIMARS. But they have done so. Now they have operational methodologies in place that minimize. Plus, they've carried out very effective counter-battery operations. The M777 is almost an extinct species right now on the battlefield. The César can't mass fires. It's moving in, firing, and leaving, because if it stays there, drones connect it, and the Russians are hitting it. And HIMARS, The Russians are shooting down 90% of the missiles launched.